Whenever I think of Absalom's rebellion against his father, the Lord's anointed, I am reminded of a saying of Lenin during the early days of the Russian Revolution in 1917. And somebody pointed out to Lenin that he was an iconoclast. He was smashing up a whole empire and a whole way of life overnight. And was it not time for the communist revolution to put the brakes on for a while and slow down? But Lenin is reputed to have shrugged his shoulders and said, "Well, if you want an omelette, it is necessary first to break eggs." A very callous principle. When the eggs that have to be broken are human beings. And it was that callous spirit that dictated Absalom's rebellion against his father. He rose against his father's authority, and beyond that, we'll see later on what is much more serious. He challenged the authority of his father's God. He wanted an omelette, you see. The omelette was the throne for Absalom. And the tragedy was that on the way to the throne, men and women were destroyed. And I should like this evening to bring out three important spiritual principles useful for Christian living today that we derive from Absalom's rebellion. You'll have noticed that chapter that we read is full of people. And there were people who got sucked into the vortex, the whirlpool of Absalom's insatiable lust for power. But God has so arranged things in this world that all lust for power costs death. The price of power is death, whether it's power in the church, power in the nation, or power in prayer. If you want power, something in you must die, because death is the price of power. And that is the first principle that we see from Absalom's rebellion. If you want power, you must be prepared to die. And this is a principle that is capable of being adapted to many levels. If you turn back to Genesis chapter 35, you'll see an example of that there. Breaking into the story of Jacob. You remember Jacob had two wives. The first one was Leah, and she was very fruitful and had many children. But poor Rachel was barren. And for years, Rachel cried to God for children. And the simple truth is, she wanted to be one up on the other wife. She wanted children as an expression of her lust for power. And for years, she cried to God for a child. And God heard her. And God gave her Joseph. And the word Joseph in Hebrew means May the Lord add. And the boy was called that because she really was saying, I want more, just to be one up on Leah. I want power over that woman with her children. And so God heard her crying. But of course, the cost of power is death. And she died having her second child. The child was called Benoni, son of sorrow. But his name was changed by his father to Benjamin, son of a father's hand. And we read this story in Genesis 35 and verse 16. It's a story that is full of pathos. Then they journeyed from Bethel, and when they were still some distance from Ephrath, that was the old name for Bethlehem, Rachel travailed, and she had hard labor. And when she was in hard labor, the midwife said to her, Fear not, for now you will have another son. And as her soul was departing, for she died, and that's the price, she called his name Benoni, son of sorrow, son of my sorrow. Benoni. But his father called his name Benjamin, son of the right hand. And so Rachel died. And that was the price of power. And she was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. And Jacob set up a pillar upon her grave. It is the pillar of Rachel's tomb, which is there to this day. Israel, that's to say, Jacob, journeyed on and pitched his tent beyond the Tower of Eder. Now, what has this got to do with Absalom? Well, simply this, that on his road to the throne, ambitious men got sucked up into Absalom's desires and Absalom's insatiable lust for power. And it's a solemn lesson that every one of them died. Joab died. Ahithophel died, and so on. And that was the price they paid for their ambition. If you care to turn up one or two scriptures, Joab, first of all, in 1 Kings, have you ever watched a good cowboy film? And there's the gambling in the saloon. And there's always a cool customer who holds his cards to the end. You know, Gregory Peck. And you get long, slow shots of his hand, you see. It's got four aces in it, or maybe five. And you know what's coming. He's playing his cards, and he's a cool customer. Joab was a brilliant gambler. Right into 1 Kings, you think he's on David's side. You think he's on the side of the royal seed, of God's anointed. You think he's one of God's men. And he sits there playing his cards, and he thinks he's got four aces, or maybe five. There aren't five aces in a pack of cards, if some of you are as innocent as that. And then Solomon becomes king, and he joins the rebellion against Solomon. You see, he didn't have any cards left at all then, because he was on the wrong side. He was against the Lord's anointed. A magnificent gambler. A chance, a chancer, a speculator. And he lost. 1 Kings chapter 2 and verse 28. When the news came to Joab, for Joab had supported Adonijah, although he had not supported Absalom, Joab fled to the tent of the Lord, which was a place of sanctuary, you see, like some of the cathedrals in England. Criminals could run into the church and reach the altar, and it was a place of safety. Joab fled to the tent of the Lord and caught hold of the horns of the altar. And when it was told King Solomon, for he's the king, Joab has fled to the tent of the Lord, and behold, he is beside the altar, Solomon sent Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, saying, "Go and strike him down." So Benaiah came to the tent of the Lord and said to him, "The king commands, come forth." He wouldn't kill him at the altar, you see. But he said, "No, I will die here." Then Benaiah brought the king word again, saying, "Thus said Joab, and thus he answered me." King Solomon replied to him, "Do as he has said. Strike him down and bury him. And thus take away from me and from my father's house the guilt for the blood which Joab shed without cause." He'd been a speculator, you see, with men's lives. "The Lord will bring back his bloody deeds upon his own head, because without the knowledge of my father David, he attacked and slew with the sword two men who were more righteous and better than himself, Abner the son of Ner, the commander of the army of Israel, and Amasa the son of Jether, commander of the army of Judah. So shall their blood come back upon the head of Joab and upon the head of his descendants forever, but to David and to his descendants and to his house and to his throne there shall be peace from the Lord forevermore." Then Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, went up and struck him down and killed him, and he was buried in his own house in the wilderness. The king put Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, over the army in the place of Joab, and the king put Zadok the priest in the place of Abiathar. Do you want power? You must die. You want spiritual power? You must die. You must die to your nerves and your shyness and your fearfulness and your timidity. Perhaps you need to die to your religion. But it's the only way. God knows if there were another way, I would tell you. Do you ever catch yourself looking at a Christian who is more powerful and more effective and more fruitful and more used than you? Have you ever caught yourself saying, "My, I wish I could live that kind of life. I wish I could produce the goods like that Christian. I wish I could pray like him." Well, maybe you can. How ready are you to die? Do you know what it costs to produce the goods for Jesus? It costs death. And Job's head rolled. 2 Samuel, the death of Ahithophel. 2 Samuel chapter 17. And, well, if you look back into chapter 16, you'll see that Ahithophel has become a kind of god. His counsel is so good that he's almost divine in his good advice. 2 Samuel 16 in the last verse, you see, "Now in those days the counsel which Ahithophel gave was as if one consulted the oracle of God. So was all the counsel of Ahithophel esteemed, both by David and by Absalom. His advice was so fine." But of course, he comes to judgment. 17. "Moreover, Ahithophel said to Absalom," this is in the rebellion, "let me choose 12,000 men, and I will set out and pursue David tonight." And so he goes on with his counsel, saying, "I'll go out with a posse and kill him for you." But Hushai, the spy who has been put into Jerusalem by David, says in verse 5, "Then Absalom said, Cush, call Hushai the Archite also, and let us hear what he has to say. And when Hushai came to Absalom, Absalom said to him, thus has Ahithophel spoken. Shall we do as he advises? If not, you speak." Then Hushai, who was David's man and David's spy, said to Absalom, "This time the counsel which Ahithophel has given is not good." And he goes on with his advice, which is that Absalom should go out with a posse. Of course, that was the cause of Absalom's death. And his advice was taken. And Ahithophel's advice was not taken. Ahithophel, this ambitious man, who sided with Absalom. And what happens? Look at verse 23. "When Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed, he saddled his ass and went off home to his own city. Set his house in order, hanged himself, he died, and was buried in the tomb of his father." All power costs death, whether it's wrong power, like these men, or whether it's right power. Jesus' power, Christian power, spiritual power, price is the same. It's death. Absalom, he too died. 2 Samuel 18 and verse 6. "So the army went out into the field against Israel, and the battle was fought in the forest of Ephraim. And the men of Israel were defeated there by the servants of David, and the slaughter there was great. And that day 20,000 men, the battle spread over the face of all the country, and the forest devoured more people that day than the sword. It seemed as if nature itself was against Absalom." The forest devoured more people that day than the sword. Later on in the chapter 16, "Then Joab blew the trumpet, and the troops came back from pursuing Israel, for Joab restrained them, and they took Absalom and threw him into a great pit in the forest and raised over him a very great heap of stones." You remember he got caught in the tree. Verse 9. "Absalom chanced to meet the servants of David. Absalom was riding upon his mule, and the mule went under the thick branches of a great oak, and his head caught fast in the oak, and he was left hanging between heaven and earth, while the mule that was under him went on. 17, and they took Absalom and threw him into a great pit in the forest, and raised over him a very great heap of stones, and all Israel fled, everyone to his own home. Now Absalom in his lifetime had taken and set up for himself the pillar which is in the king's valley, for he said, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. He called the pillar after his own name, and it is called Absalom's monument to this day. That's the first principle then. If you want power, right power, wrong power, price is death. The second principle is this. Beware of a lie that is dressed up in religious language. You see, Absalom wanted to be king. Now, in order to convince everyone that he was God's man, he had to dress it all up in religious language. And so you get all this talk about going to Hebron and worshipping the Lord and paying vows and keeping your oaths and all that sort of thing. And the whole thing was just a facade to disguise the lie at the heart of it all. He took the lie and he dressed it up in horses and chariots and his own beauty, for he was a very attractive fellow, and religion. And that's why it triumphed. This is why Paul tells us in the New Testament that when Satan comes to Christians, he comes as an angel of light. That's why he's so successful. He doesn't come dressed in tights and covered with soot and horns on his head and a long tail. Don't know who that is. It's not the biblical Satan. That's a buffoon there. That's a theatrical personage. The real Satan comes as an angel of light. And it's interesting that some of the greatest heretical movements in Christian history have come to men as angels of light. The moral rearmament movement, which hasn't much time for Jesus Christ, and yet it's so convincing with its four absolutes: absolute honesty, absolute purity, absolute self-sacrifice, absolute love. Why, A.J. Russell, one of the founders, wrote a book called For Sinners Only. People were taken in by it. They used to devise anagrams to make it all attractive. Jesus exactly suits us sinners, J-E-S-U-S. And this amazing one, Pray, P-R-A-Y, powerful radiograms, always yours. That kind of zippy, fast-selling kind of thing. And yet, from a Christian point of view, it was all fake. It was a lie dressed in religion. It's the same with Mormonism. The man who started Mormonism was a Christian, Joseph Smith. Ignorant, of course. Poor, of course. Superstitious, of course. But a real Christian. Took that lie. He dressed it up in religion. The same with Mary Baker Eddy and Christian Science, which is neither scientific, nor is it Christian. The woman who finally said there was no pain, there was no sin, there were just illusions. Pain is just an illusion. It's a fantasy. It's a figment of your own imagination. It's not real. Pain isn't real. What she'd taken was a lie. And she dressed it up and made it convincing. Beware of lies dressed up in religious clothes. And the third great principle that we learn from the rebellion of Absalom is this. You see, his rebellion was much more than a tilt at his father's power. For beyond his father's power, there was the power of his father's God. And all tilting at authority is tilting at the authority of God. Have you ever heard the Greek word exousia? It's the word that's used in the New Testament for power that is handed down. There are two Greek words for power. The most common one is dynamis, dunamis, dynamic, dynamo. That means power in itself, the power that God has, power that doesn't draw its power from anywhere else. But there's another word that's used in the New Testament, and it's the word exousia, and it means delegated power, power that God hands down to men. It's the word that's used, for example, in Mark's Gospel, when the people were sitting listening to Jesus. And we read, they were astonished, for he taught them as one with authority, and not as the scribes. Now that word authority is the word exousia, power that has been handed down to men. Later on in Mark's Gospel, the people come to Jesus and they say, by what authority doest thou these things? How dare you come in here and disturb the peace of our church? Where are your credentials? By what authority doest thou these things? Now that's the word exousia. What power handed down do you have? And the world in which we live is so constructed morally by God. That all tilting at lawful authority is in the long run a challenge to the authority of God. We were thinking this morning, briefly, about the three offices that you find in the New Testament, in the Old Testament: prophet, priest, and king. Somebody has said that that's all that the Old Testament is about: prophets, priests, and kings. Now, these were all men who had the exousia of God upon them. They all had the authority of God upon them when they were at their best. A prophet was a man who had preaching power. A priest was a man who had mediating power. He stood between men and God. A king was a man who had ruling power. And if you read the Old Testament carefully, you will find that any time men challenged the prophets, or challenged the priests, or challenged the kings, I mean the right ones, there were many wrong ones, but the right ones, ultimately, they were challenging the authority of God. Why do you think we live in an age when policemen are called nasty names. Why do you think we live in an age when the whole world of law has been challenged? Why do you think we live in an age when teachers and headmasters, who used to be authoritative figures, are now authoritative figures no longer? Why do you think we live in an age when parents are not obeyed as they should be? I'll tell you why. You see, policemen and judges and teachers and headmasters and parents and fathers are all authority figures. They have exousia upon them. They are set there by God, Romans 13. They are set there by God, and every challenge to lawful authority in the long run is a challenge to the authority of God. It's rather like a central room where all the power is. The tunnels of power come out from that central room. But if you challenge the power and go up the tunnel, sooner or later, find yourself in the central room where God Himself is. Do you believe in authority? Absalom didn't. He couldn't see that when he challenged his father, Father's throne, in the long run, it was the power behind the throne he was challenging, and it was his father's God he was challenging. Have we got these principles? If you want power, you must die. Beware of a lie that's dressed up in religious language. And the last one, and certainly not the most unimportant in this world in which we live, authority is there to be obeyed. Because the authorities in this world have the exousia of God upon them, delegated power handed down to them. And to challenge that is to challenge God Himself. Amen. May God bless the preaching of His Word.